It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Hi, I'm author Jeff Reynolds, and this is episode 19 of the Behind the Curtain podcast. This was a very interesting episode to record. My first segment features two very good longtime friends in the center-right blogging world, while my second segment features a speaker coming to Oregon to challenge our faith in Big Pharma. I've had some compelling conversations while recording this podcast, but this episode ranks as one of the most challenging. Segment 1 features a conversation with Bruce Carroll and Michelle Ray. I've known both for a decade and count them among my closest friends in the conservatarian movement. They're both heavy users of Twitter with massive followings. Well, they used to have massive followings until they were deplatformed for no reason. We talk about their individual circumstances, the lack of consistency in terms of service among social media companies, and the larger picture of what social media has done to civic discourse. Michelle used to be known on Twitter as Galt's Girl, but now she's Ragnar's mate. Bruce used to be Gay Patriot, but now he's American Homocon. Segment 2 is a different kind of conversation. Brandy Vaughn is a former employee of Merck who has become a whistleblower fighting Big Pharma. Brandy challenges many widely held assumptions about vaccines and pharmaceuticals in general. She founded the nonprofit Learn the Risk to alert the public to things they probably don't know about vaccines. She's in Portland this week to speak at an event organized by Oregonians for Medical Freedom. Like I said, this was a challenging conversation on a number of levels. You can find more information at learntherisk.org. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher Behind the Curtain will rank on podcast services like Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts, among many others. Stick around to the very end so you can hear the full version of I Am America, the theme song, by my buddy Brian Fudge. Hey, did you know I wrote a book? It's called Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. It's an examination of the dark money on the left that continues to fuel the worst of the swamp creatures in Washington, D.C. There's a real appetite out there for folks to learn about who's pulling the strings on the left and what their ultimate goals are. I've booked my trip to the East Coast to speak at my alma mater, Connecticut College, and their College Republican Club. I'll be there October 9th through the 15th, and I would love to get engaged for other gigs while I'm there. If you know of any conservative clubs, Republican groups, Tea Party or 912 clubs, or anyone else who would get something out of following the dark money on the left, please email me at info@5440fight.com. Search for Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Check out whoownsthedems.com for more information. Okay, welcome back into the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds, and I'm here with a couple of really good friends of mine who are talking about one of the biggest issues that conservatives and libertarians face these days in the digital realm of being deplatformed by various social media conglomerates. And so I'd like to welcome in Bruce Carroll, formerly Gay Patriot on Twitter, and Michelle Ray, formerly Galt's Girl on Twitter. And welcome in, guys. I really appreciate you coming on.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for coming in. Bruce, why don't we start with you and let you tell your story real quick about what happened with your Twitter handle was famous for a decade. I mean, you were one of the first people I actually connected with on Twitter that actually meant anything or you know, had any clout. What happened with Gay Patriot and where did it go?
It was permanently banned by Twitter. And the quick story was that The Gay Patriot brand and the blog that I started before Twitter is all based on free speech and contrarian views and challenging the conventional wisdom, so to speak. So the quick story is, it's almost been a year now, I think. I forget. Someone tweeted something like, here are a list of words that you're not allowed to use anymore. And that is like throwing red meat in front of a bear for me. So,
sort of like the George Carlin routine, right?
Yes, exactly. So one of the words that this individual said I was no longer allowed to use, and it wasn't directed at me, it was everyone is no longer allowed to use these words. The word that I decided to use was the word tranny, which is short for an automatic transmission in your car. So that's a joke.
It used to be anyway.
Yeah. So I retweeted that individual who I had no idea who it was. And my comment of the retweet was all the word tranny, like as many times as I could write it. You know, tranny, 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 tranny. So that got me suspended and then banned. And then so that was the end of Gay Patriot. And I don't know if it was on purpose or by design, but I've also had that account suspended before for informing everyone that Bradley Manning is a traitor. And I was accused of misgendering Bradley Manning because he now goes by Chelsea Manning.
So committing the Bruce Jenner sin, right?
Yes, ultimate sin. Yeah. So I apparently was on the tranny watch list, and this response that I made months ago caused the Gay Patriot account to be completely murdered and vanished from existence. And then a quick side note, I created a new account. And one of David Hogg's minions, who is in love with David Hogg, another gay dude.
Oh, dear.
So, like, this is an inter-gay feud now at this point.
Oh, brother.
a David Hogg apostle who's in love with him then came after me for the rule that you can't create a new account to bypass a ban. So that ended the second account that I was trying to build back, and that is how Gay Patriot vanished from existence from Twitter.
So obviously you'd been around for about a decade. How many followers did you have when you were banned?
I think it was around 75,000. It was, I know, above 70, but I can't remember if I had actually hit 75 or not, but pretty close.
Okay, so this is not some scrub account. This is somebody that actually has influence and lots of followers, and people want to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, and you know, I never did become verified. I tried a couple times. Then I decided, you know, I was going to be a rebel and never get verified. Again, I have a temper that tends to get out of control. So, I was just saying to another mutual friend of ours, Amelia Hamilton.
Oh, yeah.
That, thank goodness that I didn't rely on social media for an income. I've only ever done it to sort of have a creative outlook, but it certainly has made me sympathize with people that do use it either personally or on behalf of an organization that have had some sort of ban or suspension.
You mean other than that Instagram modeling account you have, right?
Yeah, we don't want to talk about that.
So, and not to, you know, put too much identity politics into this, but as a gay man, you'd think you would have, you know, the right from the social justice warriors to discuss issues of gender and sexuality, right?
Well, you would think so. And, you know, I will have to say that knowing that I had gay privilege for many years, I probably used that to be a little more loud than I normally would have. But I think the white privilege backlash is what got me. And
there you go.
Trannies are above the gay white social justice meter. So I lost to the trannies.
Right, right. It all depends on where you are on the totem pole, right?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So Michelle, you have a slightly different story. You weren't necessarily deplatformed, probably, maybe, but you had your account hacked, and Twitter basically refused to help you fix it. Why don't you tell the story about how you lost Galt's Girl, which, and how many followers was that? That was tens of thousands as well, right?
Yeah, I had just hit about 52,000 followers when I was the victim of a SIM swap attack. And, you know, SIM swap attacks are fairly common in the crypto community these days. And the whole purpose, of course, is generally to gain access to your prominent account, such as what happened with Jack.
Boy, was that delicious irony, wasn't it?
Well, it might have been delicious irony if it had been beneficial to anybody, but it was not. Or in my case, I'm a crypto enthusiast, and the perpetrator of the SIM swap was definitely after money. The very first thing they went after was my crypto account.
So this was a ransomware attack.
Well, you know, I don't think it was ransomware. Their goal was to wipe out my accounts. Like there was no communication. Well, I say there was no communication. So I got home one night and SIM swap attacks all happen the same. You get a notification on your phone saying that your SIM is no longer provisioned. And I just happened to be smart enough to know what that means and what was happening. So in less than 10 minutes, I was on the phone with my cell phone provider and checking all of my accounts. And while they did gain access to a lot of my accounts, luckily I got control back over all of them before 9 a.m. the next morning, with the exception of Twitter. And, I'm a rebel in terms of being a political libertarian, but I am also a firm believer in a private business's, ability to do whatever they would like as far as their users go. And the user's ability to use their very platform to trash them for those practices. But after more than 24 support ticket requests and emails to 10 different people inside of the Twitter organization, I have gotten back exactly zero responses from a real person. And normally I would be like, you know what? They just don't care, right? You're not worth it to them. But in my case, it's a little bit different. I was a verified user. And in order to get verified, I had to supply photo identification. I had to supply information about my employment, where I was working, and obviously they had my home address and my phone number was attached to the account. So in order to fix my account, which they keep telling me they cannot verify that I'm the owner.
Even though you're verified.
Even though I'm verified, they can't verify that I own the account. Because the email address and phone number associated with the account are no longer mine. So, but regardless, they have photo ID on file. I can verify the employment information that was provided. Like those are pictures of my kids on the account. I've been around for a decade as well. Literally could answer any single question about private messages long before the hack. But they won't bother. Literally zero response from a person to resolve this problem, which leaves me flabbergasted because I don't want to think it's political. I'm a libertarian, for Pete's sake. I dish it out on both sides.
Right. But you also dish it out against the left, which is not something that's acceptable.
A cardinal sin.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a card. And I've been trying to tell myself for months, so this happened at the end of April, trying to tell myself for months that this is not political. This is literally just lazy users or lazy support or whatever. But at this point, Twitchy wrote a quick article about it. I've gotten hundreds of retweets of my pleas. I've had people who've had conversations with Jack in the past, tag him and say, hey, dude, she went through the same thing you did. Fix this. Literally zero response from Twitter.
And that's just bizarre to me because, in Bruce's case, that he was obviously targeted and he obviously got on their radar. But the silent treatment from Twitter in your case doesn't make any sense in a vacuum because, yes, there are millions of users. But when you have a serious issue like this, especially with a verified account, I mean, the idea that you're not getting a response is unfathomable.
Yeah, no. And I've seen verified accounts since who were political and some who were not get their accounts back pretty quickly. They filed a report and I've had people tell me, hey, look, I'm not verified. I got hacked and I got my account back in, a couple weeks. So with me, I'm literally like at a complete loss as to something that is a quick 5 minutes, shoot me an email to verify some information. I've even sent them a copy of the same photo ID I used to verify the account from the email address that had the account for 10 years. And their response is always the same. We can't verify you're the owner of this account.
Wow. That's amazing. So there's plausible deniability sort of in your case, Michelle. Bruce, it seems pretty obvious that you were targeted for political reasons. How big a problem is the political targeting by digital companies? Bruce, you go first. What do you think the biggest issues are, and how big are they?
I think they're pretty big, but I'm going to speak a lot from conjecture because I've only heard things through other Twitter users and conservative media folks. So, I don't have any facts per se that are documented. But what I've heard and observed is that the excuse, I guess, at least from Twitter, is that they have algorithms that filter out or tag offensive behavior. So I was actually shown a list of words that we shouldn't use on Twitter because that'll get you suspended or banned. And of course, I think the first thing I did was tweet all of those words in one tweet immediately, right?
Of course.
Right. But, training is one of those words. But, all of the words are ones that and I wish I would have thought to print out the list, but these are words that you wouldn't think are offensive, that probably more people engaged in politics would use or refer to. And so, you have the list of words that get tagged and you get suspended for that. The other problem is I know that liberal groups pay people like David Hogg's little friend to find offensive conservative tweets based on their definition and do like a mass reporting event.
Yeah.
I have no idea if I was a victim of that. I don't know. Like, I don't know what happened that caused the tranny tweet to be tagged. I don't know if it was an algorithm or, someone was following me and saw their chance or something. But I do understand that groups like Think Progress, they're out of business. liberal groups pay, college kids or whoever.
Tides Foundation, the Media Matters, all those groups.
They pay people to sit online all day and go after people for political speech that they find offensive. So, I've been suspended many times before the eventual ban. And, again, unlike Michelle, I could rationalize why one would have suspended Gay Patriots account for, offensive language and using words that are on the naughty list and ruffling people the wrong way. I disagree with the reasons why I was banned, and I think that it is on purpose, but I would say I can sort of understand why my account was banned as opposed to Michelle's, which, especially in her attempts to try to restore it, it has shown that, maybe there is a political link to her case. It's very bizarre to me that, and I know what she's been going through because I've tried to amplify her problems as well on Twitter. And so it's sort of mystifying that she hasn't been able to resolve this by now.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely a mystery unless you eliminate all the stuff that isn't true and you come back to the conjecture that it's political targeting. And the preponderance of the evidence seems to point in that direction. Michelle, what do you think about the size of the problem, the scope of the problem, and what are we what can we do about it? You know, I mean, there's quite a debate about whether social media companies are free speech platforms or whether they are content delivery platforms. When they're making these kinds of decisions, doesn't that change the character of what they are?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a huge debate. Everybody is trying to employ Section 230 of the common decency regs and saying that making editorial decisions like muting users, force deleting tweets, suspending them, not just on Twitter, but other platforms as well, Facebook, Reddit, whatever, is akin to being a publisher. And not just a platform in which all users are subject to the exact same rules, regulations, you know, support, whatever. And interestingly, regardless of whether a private platform or a private company supplies a platform or enforces their own type of censorship, they are not running afoul of Section 230. Actually, Section 230 empowers them to meet common decency regulations by employing their own censorship. Now, the issue becomes with Twitter and all of the allegations of Twitter is that they're not employing that type of censorship equally, and users are, you know, starting to raise a stink about it, and Twitter doesn't seem to care. I think the problem is a big one in only that the rest of the world that isn't super tech savvy, that still hangs out on Facebook or hangs out on Twitter, is unduly influenced because they're not early adopters of competitive technologies. So there are competitors out there. If you don't like Twitter's policies, if you don't like Facebook peeking into your every move, there are competitors out there. But getting people to move over to them is a really difficult task. I mean, people don't really like change and they want to be heard in the audiences on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. So the difficulty becomes, you know, for us is, do we continue to amplify what appear to be very biased and one-sided applications of censorship rules? Or do we just, you know, focus on en masse supporting a competitor? Obviously, I'm an early adopter of a lot of technologies. I talk a lot on Twitter about those competitors, but I'm still on Twitter because that is where my voice at least used to be amplified, and I was able to engage in conversations, you know, about everything from music to food to politics. And now, obviously, that voice has been drastically reduced, not just by losing my Gold Scroll account and the larger following I had. And I won't lie, there's definitely preferential treatment to content that's put out by verified users, but by the fact that I think the algorithms put in place under the guise of creating a healthier conversation for Twitter users suppress certain types of conversation, not just political, by the way. I think it suppresses anything that might, you know, actually cause a stir in a way that Twitter doesn't approve of.
Yeah, you know, and Bruce brought up the idea, you know, he's seen the algorithms and the list of words that aren't allowed on social media. And I've seen lists like that being, you know, floating around on social media as well. But I've always suspected that they blame the algorithms a little bit too easily. And there's definitely more of a human element to this. To me, it just seems like the algorithm is kind of the man behind the curtain. There's actually a large fleet of workers there that are manually enforcing these kinds of things instead of an algorithm, you know, making it look like a computer mistake when it's really some, you know, some leftist employee in Silicon Valley actually making these decisions. Is there any validity to my suspicion there? Bruce, why don't you go ahead first?
You know, I think we'd have to see the books and evidence from Twitter, but I think you're right. And I think that the evidence is public, which is all of the mistakes go in one direction. And you never hear, except maybe the Krasenstein brothers who were defrauding people with solicitation of money, You just don't hear of notable leftist accounts being banned in the same way that, I mean, we all know many friends on Twitter that have been suspended and banned. And, you know, the even the crazy accounts like Alex Jones are all conservative crazy accounts. And, you know, you really have to think about liberal crazy accounts that we know of that have been banned. And, you know, I just can't think of any to the same extent that we know notable conservative accounts, whether we agree with them or not. The mistakes do seem to all go in one direction.
Yeah. You know, and that kind of points to a larger effort on the left that I've noticed for a long time where, you know, they go for Alex Jones and then they go for the Proud Boys and they go for the Patriot prayer groups that are protesting in Portland, those kinds of things. And they want to, you know, the white supremacists from Charlottesville, all that stuff. They point out the most extreme examples and then they want to lump us all in with those same people. And so it makes it appear that, A, those problems are a lot bigger than they are, and B, that all conservatives are basically like the Proud Boys or white supremacists. You know, that's to me, that's what they're trying to do when they ban Alex Jones from Twitter. It's kind of the same thing.
Well, and I would argue that you really don't even need somebody manually doing this, the group of people who are writing and developing and enforcing the software are all of a certain mindset. And they're developing that algorithm. So they're the ones that determine the banned speech and the enforcement behind that. And while there are certainly, you know, manual processes and reviews on all platforms, you don't need an army of anti-conservative, anti-libertarian, super hardcore left people to do the work of an algorithm written by people who share that mindset. And I, you know, in Twitter's case, for example, Jack is very, very blunt about, you know, where his ideology lies. He's very public about it. I don't know if you guys ever saw the interview that he did with Tim Pool, where he was, you know, where they were really unable to discount instances of bias and Jack swore up and down. They were, you know, trying to make this algorithm function without, you know, bias, but he freely admitted that, you know, again, it's written by people, enforced by people, designed by people who are all of a like mindset. And that was, you know, that was a year ago. I don't see dramatic changes on Twitter's platform as to, you know, how this is enforced. This is very, very, very frustrating for me, as you can imagine, because I made a very concerted effort on Twitter after my first couple of years to really, when I did talk politics, to be, you know, consistently libertarian ideology, you know, when the right did bad, they did bad. When the left did bad, they did bad. And so what it looks like to me is it doesn't matter whether you're centrist or you're less biased. If you say anything negative about any ideology that, you know, the homogeneous thought think tank at Twitter all believes in, you're screwed. You know, you're not gonna, now they haven't. So I do have a secondary account. Obviously I'm still on Twitter with a secondary account since I can't access my primary, and no one's banned me or reported me yet, but I would assume that if someone took it upon themselves to do so, they would ban me just for having, you know, what they would still consider a secondary account, even though I can't access my primary. Like I have zero faith that there is any opportunity for me to grow my presence on Twitter in the way that I was able to do before I was so conveniently removed from the platform.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting point, because the era of social media, we all sort of got into it on the ground floor, right? This is, you know, post MySpace, but, you know, YouTube starts taking off and Facebook and Twitter start taking off. And before they really even thought that there was a quote, hate speech problem. It was the Wild West, and you were able to really grow that stuff organically. Now, when you post something on Facebook, you can tell ahead of time how far it's going to be promulgated based on the subject matter. You know, with Twitter, we've seen shadow banning going on for years now, and it's a completely different world. Somebody just now getting into social media can't grow their accounts the way that we did when we were first getting involved, unless they toe the line of as you put it, Michelle, the groupthink out
there. Right. Well, I'll be honest with you. I left Facebook. I left Facebook at the end of 2018. Like the Cambridge Analytica stuff for me, the way the algorithm was affecting my feed, my engagement levels, you know, much like they did on Twitter, started to plummet. And I'm not even mm-hmm. one of those people who's like outrageously shouty about my politics. You know, even when I do post political content, I'm pretty mellow.
Are you looking at me, Michelle?
No, I wouldn't call you outrageously shouty. I would call you outrageously giffy.
Jiffy.
Let's not have, we're gonna have that debate on here.
So I assume you guys both saw the interview or the Senate testimony from that Harvard professor who voted for Hillary Clinton. He was being questioned by Ted Cruz about how many votes were swayed by bias in social media, right? Yeah.
Yep.
So that's the kind of stuff that really concerns me, right? Is, you know, so many people get all of their information from social media, including me, you know, and I'm savvy enough not to be swayed by, you know, suppression of information. But a lot of folks don't really understand where their information comes from. And that could have a profound effect on upcoming elections. Bruce, what do you think ought to be done about that?
Well, I know Michelle and I are going to disagree about this. And I'm not a,
well, don't forget, nobody ever listens to the libertarian chick. So,
I'm generally not for big government, as a conservative, but I actually think to Michelle's points about the law, I think Twitter and Facebook, I think are both sort of trying to have it both ways. And I really think that at some point, despite the fact that these are private entities, they have a lot more power in the communications realm than, to be quite honest, almost anyone in government except maybe the President of the United States. I mean, I would argue that Twitter management has more control over American free speech, if you want to call it that. I know it's not the legal term, but free speech than all of the U.S. senators. So I don't know what the answer is. You know, I'm not up on the law, and I'm certainly not ideologically inclined to regulate them. But I just think that we've reached a point where they really control a lot of the speech in this country. And even though the First Amendment only applies to government, I think there has to be some balance for all the reasons that we've talked about.
Michelle, your rebuttal?
Yeah, no, obviously, as a diehard libertarian, I'm really against regulating and policing private entities and private businesses. And in the case of Twitter, while I do not disagree with Bruce at all that a disproportionate number of politically active people either already get their news on social media or seek out social media because they've heard that's the place to meet their tribe and stay informed. I think the solution is not so much using the state to regulate them, because whoever is in power is going to regulate them to their benefit. And you know, that will just, you know, the first regulation you put in place might sound really, really good, but that is going to start to apply to platforms that say are not biased or not biased in the right way, depending on who's in office. And I think the answer, as I do in all cases of somebody who's grown too big for their britches, is that there's a whole world out there of competition. If people are really upset about it, the best way to destroy a business is not to give them your business. You know, boycotts are the worst thing ever because they draw attention. Just leave. Support somebody that does things the way you think they should be done. And I know everybody, especially on this call, is a fighter, right? They're an ideological fighter. They're out there fighting for ideas. And you think if I'm on this smaller platform, I can't, nobody's going to hear my ideas. But I have news for you. If you've been on Twitter lately, you know nobody's listening anyway, except for the people who already agree with you. Right? Unless...
That's absolutely true.
You know, yes, you're shouting into the crowded mob of angry people carrying torches on Twitter, but you're not changing anybody's mind there anymore. So for me in particular, Twitter no longer served the purpose I was using it for politically, which was just to have conversations with people I agreed with and disagreed with, to sharpen my argument points. Now I can't even get somebody to argue intelligent with me. I get memes and trolls and I can't, you know, there's literally no political use case for me. I don't need to rally the troops. That's not why I'm there. So for me, the options are I use Twitter, you know, where it's still useful, and I throw my full weight and support behind competitors that I think are doing a much better job.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty interesting point, because I've disengaged quite a bit as well, except for, you know, occasional professional engagements where I'm out there trying to spread the word for clients. But other than that, I'm barely on Twitter anymore anyway. And Facebook is just for silly memes, you know, so it doesn't really do anything for me. But at the same time, you know, It's very troubling that it's something that only affects us and doesn't affect the other guys. And there's a sense of fairness about that. That's it's not being met, you know? So do you just disengage altogether, or, you know, the other bigger question is, should we just disengage in general because it's not really healthy for us? And it is social media. I'll ask you this, Bruce, is social media the cause of, or the evidence of, this idea that we're at each other's throat and there's this mob mentality, this rage mentality? We've got to purify the speech that's being promulgated.
I will say I'm a alcoholic for Twitter. I've been given enough signs from God that I should disengage, and I can't seem to do it. I would say that I think social media actually makes a representative republic form of government a lot tougher. And I was thinking about this over the weekend. You know, we have immediate access and sway all the way to the president of the United States now, which, you know, is really bizarre. And so the mob is ruling, because if you get a tidal wave of opinion on Twitter, and again, you know, I think we probably all agree that tidal wave seems to always go in one direction, you know, you'll suddenly have a Supreme Court justice up for impeachment hearings because Twitter flipped out over the weekend. I mean, that's really not how our system of government was supposed to work. So again, I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's become a very toxic environment for the type of dialogue that Michelle talked about. And, you know, I can't say that I'm one of the angels on Twitter or social media or the blogosphere. I never claimed to be. But I can recognize that I think that the obsession with social media and getting in everybody's face to say that you're right and that you have to have the last word on something is very deconstructive to a representative republic like we are supposed to have.
Yeah, that's also true. I was just thinking the other a few minutes ago that the idea of red flag laws is kind of the same thing that Michelle was talking about with over-regulating or a slippery slope of seemingly innocent regulations. And you look at that, or you look at the climate debate and all of these, you know, 12-year-olds and 16-year-olds that are trying to have this climate strike. This is not, this is ab- actual mob rule that they're trying to enforce, and it's only being amplified by social media. Michelle, what do you think about that? Is that something that's a destructive force? Obviously, how do we conduct our slow, deliberative governmental processes in this environment?
Yeah, so that's the dilemma for people who are, whether you just pay attention to politics or whether you're politically active, is this is the tool du jour, right? For politicians, for activists, for the media, this is how your message gets spread. But if your message is not getting spread, then what? You know, we keep fighting, right? We keep coming on Twitter and we're pointing out media bias and we're pointing out, you know, Twitter, you know, shadow banning or banning conservatives or applying their own rules in, you know, one direction or another. And I still, like Bruce, I don't have an answer for you, because you're not going to, if you haven't figured out by now that you're not going to change somebody's mind on a political issue with a tweet or a Facebook post, you know, you're on Twitter just to shout into the void like a lot of other people are, or to rally behind your side, right? You're not a thought leader, or, you know, you're not even really all that serious. And most of the time, you're probably never leaving your keyboard. But for those of us who genuinely are trying to affect, you know, some kind of political change, or just some kind of awareness about things, I have found that Twitter is not just toxic, like not just toxic in terms of being able to talk to other people. It's toxic in terms of feeling like you're able to accomplish anything. You spend 2, 3, 4, 10 hours a day. I mean, look, Gulch Girl had 700,000 tweets and none of those were automated, right? None of those were automatic tweets. I just didn't sleep. But, you know, you start to look back at what you've been trying to do and the reaction you've gotten from it. And we just reached a point in my mind on Twitter where if you were not shouting loudly, using the language of your tribe and reinforcing the message of those tribes' leaders, you just were not heard. You want to talk to somebody about right to work legislation right now with the AUW and GM strike going on? No one's going to listen. You know, it's you hate blue collar workers. You love blue collar workers. That's the only conversation being had. You're good. You're evil. There is no discussion anymore. And so for me, I haven't disengaged in Twitter on Twitter. What I've done is I've disengaged from my original purpose on Twitter, which was to have meaningful, rational discussions about policy solutions to problems that weren't based on magic math or, you know, some extreme ideology, that were based on, you know, constitutional grounding, reality, math, yada, yada. Now I talk about music and crypto and bourbon, and very rarely do I engage specifically in politics, because I might as well be shouting into the wind.
Well, there's also a difference between engaging on politics and engaging on policy, right? Policy is boring. Policy is slow.
Hey, now.
for most people, not us nerds. But it's, you know, that politic, the political arguments are really what's driven.
Right. Most does of that make you feel good? History. I mean, but does that make you feel good? Like, so on Twitter for me, and I'm asking this really of both of you. I mean, I have followed you both long enough to know your tweet styles, your blog styles, your Facebook styles, you know, whatever. It's good when you get a banter going, even if it's not a friendly banter. You've got a challenge out there when you're talking about politics and you've got somebody who can meet you tit for tat, and you're still having a very public conversation, expressing ideas. Now, though, I don't even see that happening. Now it's who can take down whom fastest. And it doesn't matter if you're saying anything logical. I mean, I don't know about your mentions, but mine are a bunch of incoherent tweets that just repeat the same fallacies over and over. Like, I don't even respond to that stuff.
Yeah, on both sides, by the way, not just on the left.
Yeah. Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's become very tribal. I agree with both of you. And, you know, Jeff, something that you said is something that I do all the time, which is I feel like I have to overcompensate for stupidity and factual ignorance. So that is all I'm doing, is fighting. to try to create an awareness of an alternate viewpoint or, you know, potentially the actual facts as opposed to memes that, you know, reinforce the type of tribal behavior that Michelle is talking about. So, yeah, I mean, I agree completely with Michelle that all I feel like I'm doing, and again, I'm now, you know, unable to tear away from it sometimes, but all I feel I'm doing is just biting and not really being productive and getting into the same kind of tit for tat that, you know, we realize isn't very healthy or productive at all.
Yeah, you know, one of these days we might actually get back to arguing on facts and policy and results instead of this tribalism, but it doesn't seem like it's going to be today.
Or on Twitter. I mean, yeah. Listen, all technologies are replaced, all of them. At, you know, all of them have a shelf life. Twitter is desperately trying to remain relevant in social media by providing a certain member of their user base with tools to keep them aboard. You know, the blue checkmark brigade, of which I had a blue checkmark, but giving them tools that keep them coming back and keep feeding their ego. That doesn't translate into, you know, downloads. It doesn't translate into subscribers. And eventually there will be a tool that is just better. So I'm hoping it's sooner rather than later.
Well, one can only hope and pray. So at that point, thanks, Michelle and Bruce. I think this is a good time to wrap it up. But before we go, let's cause some trouble some more and give people your new Twitter account handle so that they can follow you and get you in more trouble.
Go ahead, Michelle.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Ragnar's Mate.
And Bruce?
I am now known as American HomoCon with all the vowels included.
The vowels are very important. And I of course, am on Twitter at Charger Jeff. Once in a while, I actually tweet. So thanks, Michelle Ray and Bruce Carroll. I really appreciate you coming on the show. This was a lot of fun, and we'll have to do this again sometime.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
If you like this podcast, the best way you can support it is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Now it's on to my second interview with Brandi Vaughn of Learn the Risk. Welcome back to the Behind the Curtain podcast. My name is Jeff Reynolds. I'm your host, and I'm here with Brandi Vaughn, who is coming to Portland on Thursday, September 19th, to give a talk for Oregonians for Medical Freedom. Brandi is a former insider for Merck, the pharmaceutical company, and she's going to talk about vaccines and medical freedom. So, Brandi, welcome in. Tell me what you're going to be talking about on Thursday and how you kind of got involved in this medical freedom movement.
Hi. So thanks for having me on. And I'm really excited to come to Portland on Thursday and share my story because I believe it's an important story. Not very many people who used to work inside the pharmaceutical industry are brave enough, or some, you know, there's also a thin line between brave and stupid. But yeah, to speak out against the world's most powerful and most profitable industry. And I feel like it's my life mission to help people see the real risks of the products that the pharmaceutical industry is pushing, both pharmaceutical drugs, unnecessary medical treatments, as well as vaccines. So I will be sharing some powerful information on Thursday, and I hope some of your listeners can join us. So how did I get started? Because you can imagine that growing up, I never wanted to be a pharmaceutical whistleblower. I never wanted to speak out against the world's most powerful industry. And especially when you work inside of it, they make it very clear that they won't make your life easy if you do speak out. But what I experienced on the inside was horrific and mind-blowing and eye-opening for me. And it's information that people need to hear. So I started working for Merck, and I started selling a drug in the early 2000s called Vioxx. it was a painkiller. You might remember it. It's one of the most infamous medical scandals.
Sure.
In the U.S. And eventually Vioxx was pulled off the market after 5 years, but it was a blockbuster for Merck, even after the $6 billion in payouts for injuries and victims that died from the drug, as well as fraud to the U.S. government. It was still a blockbuster. And what I saw and what has come out in court documents is very much what I saw from the inside, that the drug was kept on as long as possible, and the emphasis was on the profit and how much money they could make versus the harm that it was doing to patients. So being in that industry and seeing that firsthand, I left the company over it, and also seeing how other companies do very much the same and how the whole industry works was so eye-opening. And what most people don't understand is the pharmaceutical industry only makes money when you're sick, right? So if people sit and take a couple seconds to think about that, do you think that your doctor, who really his only tools to leave you with after an appointment is a pharmaceutical drug, and you think that he really wants you healthy, but yet the doctor, as well as the pharmaceutical companies, which are pretty much hand in hand most of the time these days, not all doctors, but most, they only make money when you come back, when you're a recurring customer, when you take the drugs, when then it causes an issue that makes you to take, forces you to take a second drug or a third drug, or something affects your body, that drug affects your body chemically, that your body stops producing certain stuff that we need. So, this reoccurring cycle of creating customers out of people rather than actually trying to maintain it and make people healthier was really eye-opening for me. And the industry is completely focused on profit and not patients and not people and not health. So it's up to us to really get a step out of that cycle and really take back our health from an industry, again, that profits only when we're sick. So I stepped out of the industry. I did something completely different. I went into marketing and communications and strategy. And I had my own consulting. I moved to Europe. I saw how things were done completely differently in Europe and how people were so much healthier. So the U.S., statistics-wise, is one of the sickest, chronically ill countries in the world. And we're also the ones that take the most drugs and have the highest vaccine schedule. This is not a coincidence, right? Doctors would always love to blame your genetics so that they can write you a chemical-based pill or vaccine and just send you right out the door. But it's not keeping us healthy. Statistically, we have the worst health. But it's not that we have a lack of healthcare, because we also pay more per capita than for healthcare than any other country in the world as well. And we are very over-medicated and over-medicalized as a society. So I saw things differently, done differently in Europe. And then I had my son. And I started looking into all medical products. I had a home birth over in Holland where I had him, and it was a very different mindset. So when I came back to the U.S. with my son when he was 4 to 6 months, they were pushing vaccines and, doctor visits and all of these things that weren't done in Holland. And it really made me suspicious, of course, because I used to work in the industry. And I remember a pediatrician appointment when he was 6 months old, and the doctor said, "Oh, we're going to have to give him a dozen vaccines. He hasn't had any." And I said, "Yeah, but he's perfectly healthy. We're not going to Africa. Why is he needing vaccines?" And you don't need vaccines for Africa. But that's another story. And he kept pushing, and he's like, "Well, I'm the doctor, so I know best." And I said, "You know what? I used to work for Merck, for the pharmaceutical industry, and I'm going to do my own research." And he got really red in the face, got really angry with me. And I was like, "Whoa, what happened? I mean, shouldn't people do their own research, right? I mean, as a parent, this is my child. And I'm the one who's going to deal with any consequences and side effects of these drugs or vaccines." And so he, walked out of the room, slammed the door. And that was when my research started into vaccines. And what I found was horrific. And it's interesting, because they like to say that, those who choose not to vaccinate — my son is vaccine free. He's 8 years old. He's super healthy, not allergic to anything, no chronic health issues. So basically not a good pharmaceutical customer. But they like to say, "Oh, it's because of Jenny McCarthy or Andy Wakefield or any of these things." And I knew nothing of that when I started my research. What I did know was about the body and about chemistry because I studied biochemistry for years. And I read the science, and the science supports the link between vaccines and side effects. And it's interesting because when you have this conversation, people understand drug side effects. People understand that the pharmaceutical companies create customers with opiates and other things, right? And by the way, there are a dozen opiates, and the pharmaceutical industry as a whole is responsible for the crisis, not just one company, not just one scapegoat. They understand that we can't trust pharma. They understand that pharma is out for profits. But when you talk about vaccines, it's like vaccines are held up on a pedestal. They are made by pharmaceutical companies. They are very, very profitable. In fact, Pfizer's best-selling product is a vaccine. It's not a drug. It's not Viagra. It's not one of their cholesterol medications. It's a vaccine. And people just don't seem to connect the dots. So you wouldn't trust pharma with your child, with the opiates, those type of things. But then a lot of people won't do any research into vaccines and the chemicals that they contain. And I did that research. So I chose to step out of that system and keep my son vaccine free. He is completely healthy, far, far healthier than his peers. And it's shocking to me that we now have half of all children in the U.S. chronically ill. Because when I grew up in the 80s, we didn't need EpiPens in every classroom. We didn't have peanut allergies. We didn't have food allergies at the skyrocketing rates we have now. We didn't have one in 200 children with cancer, skyrocketing cancer rates now in the U.S. And all of these different things. And doctors like to blame it on genetics, which, we have, our genes were born healthy. It takes a toxic trigger to change our genes and our genetics. So that's just really an excuse to keep you coming back for more. But it was eye-opening to see how sick children are in the U.S., how many children are on medications, and how many chronically ill and children dying of cancer. It's the second leading cause of death in children. When I was growing up, I didn't know anyone with cancer that wasn't over 60 years of age. And, cancer is a disease of toxicity, and this is that they admit, right? But it used to take years and years and years for people to be under the levels of toxicity that causes cancer, and now we're seeing it in skyrocketing amounts in children. So, we really have to look at our lifestyle as a whole. And when I looked into what vaccines contain and the ingredients and the chemicals and the science on the toxicity of the chemicals that are being injected into children, it was not mind-blowing for me to realize that this is the connection of why we have such chronically ill children in the U.S. So I feel like only 4 years ago did I start speaking out about this, but it was in relation to some of the medical mandates going through in California and the infamous SB 277, which took away my son's right to go to public school or private school in California as a kindergartner. And now we're seeing those medical mandates being, forced in other states as well. And people just not understanding that we cannot give up our medical freedom in terms of any kind of medical product or pharmaceutical product, because this huge push for vaccines, it's not about people. It's not about health. Pharma doesn't make any money if you're healthy. It's about getting these chemicals into your system so that at some point, sometimes right away, sometimes it takes weeks, months, sometimes years, but you will end up with some kind of health issue due to toxicity and inflammation in the body. And you will go running to your doctor and you will go running, he will go running to the pharmaceutical industry to give you tools, but these tools don't actually create health. And this is what I'm seeing. I'm seeing this cycle. So 4 years ago, when these mandated vaccine laws began to come into play, I realized that someone has to speak out about this because it's just creating a cycle of sickness and we are dying younger. In fact, the U.S. is the only developed country where life expectancy is suddenly going down in the last 6 years. This is not a coincidence. It's because so much of the toxicity linked to drugs and vaccines and anything injected is far more potent than anything you eat. So someone had to speak out about this. So I decided to come out. As you can imagine, pharmaceutical companies have not made my life very easy in the last 4 years. But that's another story. I'll be telling possibly some of those stories on Thursday night if any of your listeners want to join the Portland event. And it has been kind of a roller coaster, but it's incredible how many people I have, how many emails, how many messages, how many people come up to me and say, thank you for what you're doing because my child had a reaction to a vaccine, or my father died of a stroke within 12 hours of getting the flu shot, or my, you know, there was a hospital error and my mother was dead, you know. So many people that experience side effects of drugs, vaccines, all of these different things. You know, almost every family in the U.S., I feel like, has been touched by some kind of medical incident that really opens their eyes. And now we just have to kind of connect the dots for people and get people to go a level deeper and really start questioning what we're allowing pharmaceuticals to push and to mandate for our children and ourselves. So, because adult mandates will follow childhood mandates very quickly afterwards.
All right. There's a lot to unpack there, Brandy. Wanted to ask you a question about, you talked about the sickness level and how chronically ill children are in America. And you're making the claim that it's connected to vaccines. Do you know specifically which chemicals it is that's causing this? And do you have statistics to show how much sicker children are today than a generation or two ago?
Yeah. So first I want to go back on one of the semantics of your question. It's not my claim. There are thousands of scientific studies that never make the media because the pharmaceutical companies are one of the largest advertisers for media these days. Hospital systems as well. You see the ads everywhere. My claim is actually supported by thousands of scientific studies that are showing the links between autoimmune issues, cancer, a lot of these things that we're seeing throughout our children, asthma, food allergies. The science is there when you look at it and when you go into it. And I have thousands of studies on my website, learntherisk.org. So learntherisk.org. And it shows the links between a lot of these common chronic illnesses, especially the ones that we're seeing in children and also women, you know, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, all of these inflammatory diseases, and links to vaccines, case studies, as well as epidemiological studies. So the science is there to connect the dots. Some of the chemicals that they're injecting, one of which I just launched a page last night on childhood cancer rates, and one of the leading causes of childhood cancer, one of the leading types of childhood cancer that is leukemia. And right now, the EPA is hiding, covering up a government scientist report that shows the link between formaldehyde and in tiny doses and leukemia. And Reuters did a whole expose on that last summer when the whistleblower came out to them and said, you know, the EPA is covering up this report. And formaldehyde is in childhood vaccines. So, you know, this is the thing that they embalm dead people with and that you preserve organs in. And it is a known carcinogen. So it's known to cause cancer in humans. And the pharmaceutical and chemical industry would like you to think that in tiny doses, it doesn't matter. But those tiny doses add up, especially because they're injected. So these chemicals get lodged in our body tissues. And there are science studies, again, on the website that show that a study done on aluminum, which is also in childhood vaccines, that it builds up over time. So when you're giving 35 injections, 35 vaccine doses to children under, you know, 5 and 26 by age 1, you know, these are going to add up to definitely toxic levels. So this, you know, of course, the pharmaceutical company doesn't want to admit that because they'd be open to liability. Same with doctors. So many people don't understand that doctors would have liability. They're never going to admit that vaccines or drugs cause the side effects because they open themselves up to liability. So the, you know, other chemicals. So formaldehyde, there's a lot of studies, a lot of science out there on formaldehyde. IARC, the leading cancer research institute, determined that formaldehyde was causing cancer in humans back in 2011. That's when the EPA began to study formaldehyde in doses and its link with lymphomas and leukemia. And the report is ready, apparently, according to the whistleblower, and the EPA is covering it up. So, you know, is it a coincidence that formaldehyde is in most childhood vaccines? We give 26 by age one, and then cancer is now the second leading cause of death in children, particularly leukemia. Is that a coincidence? Pharmaceutical companies would say yes, because they make money off these vaccines. I would tell you that any amount of a poison that's injected will add up and build up and can cause these issues, as you know, cancer and leukemia. And the science is there. So aluminum is another one. Aluminum and mercury, but mercury is in flu shots. And this is that's one of the most deadly chemicals known to man. And it's particularly in flu shots, multivial flu shots. So a lot of the flu shots that you're getting at CVS, Walgreens, you know, these types of places are going to contain mercury, even the ones for children. So that one, the flu shot is one of the most highly reported vaccines to cause sudden death in all ages, adults as well as children. And that's the government reporting system called VAERS, where I get those stats from. So aluminum, it is not made in our body. There's no reason for aluminum or mercury to be inside our bodies. It is a heavy metal. It causes inflammation, and it particularly lodges into fatty tissues in the body, and the body builds scar tissue and inflammation around it when it's there. So this is, you know, we're seeing hundreds and hundreds of studies on aluminum and high levels of aluminum in Alzheimer's patients when they dissect the brain after death. It's also been linked to cancers, especially, you know, at sites close to aluminum buildup like deodorant and things like that. So when you inject aluminum, our bodies don't filter it in the same way as whether, you know, if you eat it. So say it's in the air, it comes down on a piece of fruit, you eat that fruit. 95% is basically filtered through our body and is excreted. But when you inject something, it is a completely different scenario. And it's actually the flip side. Almost 90% is absorbed into our body and stays in our body. And this is going to cause chronic inflammation. So it could cause, depending on what your genetics are, asthma, autoimmune issues, brain damage, Alzheimer's, these type of things. And it builds up in our system. So aluminum is another heavy metal chemical that is in vaccines. Barium is another heavy metal. It's in one of the flu shots right now. Let's see, monosodium glutamate. You're not supposed to eat it in Chinese food, but pharmaceutical companies would like you to believe that injecting it is perfectly safe. It's an exotoxin. It excites the brain and nervous cells. So we have a lot of anxiety in our society, right? A lot of migraines, anxiety, these type of issues. And MSG, monosodium glutamate, has been linked to these type of issues. ADHD as well, focus issues. So again, things that, you know, parents go to the doctor for, and then they end up with medicated children. So the pharmaceutical companies are in a win-win situation, right? We push the vaccines heavily in the media. We demonize anybody who speaks out against them. And then you have to go back to the doctor because it's going to create some kind of health issue. And then we're going to try to medicate you or your child. So this is where I talk about the cycle of sickness and how it's basically just creating customers. This is why vaccines are so sacred and why they put so much money and media into, you know, pushing this idea that you shouldn't even question vaccines. They should be unquestionable. When did any medical product become unquestionable? So many medical products have been pulled off the market, including vaccines. The FDA has very little money to study them. Drugs as well as vaccines. There are recalls all the time. Look at what happened with Vioxx, was on the market 5 years and killed, you know, over 100,000 people. There are things, situations like this all the time. So when is it ever wrong to question a medical product, especially when it's being injected, which is far, far more potent than anything you eat or drink? So, you know, it's an important conversation that needs to be had. One thing, you know, one specific, I'll talk about aluminum real quick. In lab rats, they, if they want to create an autoimmune cascade or asthma, food allergies, they use injections of aluminum. So this is what they do in scientific labs when they want to study maybe a drug. They want to study a drug on asthmatic patients, right? So the lab animals are given an injection of aluminum to create asthma. Asthma is now one of the leading causes of death in children, and the numbers have been skyrocketing. So, I mean, really, you know, the studies are there showing that an injection of aluminum can cause asthma, yet your doctor and the pharmaceutical companies will say, nope, vaccines are absolutely safe. No, you know, no side effects at all. Your, that asthma that developed right after the vaccine had nothing to do with the vaccine. And, you know, it's just shocking what that they can get away with and what parents aren't seeing, I guess, aren't connecting the dots.
So I want to forgive my ignorance because I'm not familiar with a lot of these issues that you've brought up. So I want to talk to you about a couple of statements you made about the rates of asthma in children skyrocketing. Do you have specific numbers on that? Because I had asthma as a kid and I've kind of gotten over it as an adult. But, you know, I had it. So, you know, I knew other kids that had it, too. How much has that increased from a generation or two ago? And then you also made the statement about leukemia being the second leading cause of death in children.
Cancer is the second leading cause and leukemia is the number one cancer in children.
Yeah, right. Okay, my bad. So what are the numbers on those? How much more prevalent is it than it was a generation or two ago?
So in terms of cancer rates, they've quadrupled since the 1980s, 1990s, whatever numbers you want to take. In fact, a lot before the 1980s, they really didn't even study childhood cancer because childhood cancer wasn't even a thing. Now it is, and it's shot up to become the second leading cause after accidents of death in children. One in 218 children will get cancer before their 20th birthday. To me, that is insane. So we're talking, if you have a school of 1,000 children, 4 of those children will be diagnosed with cancer. That never happened. I didn't know anyone in any of my schools that were diagnosed with cancer when I was in school. You know, it's shocking to even think that children are getting cancer these days because it used to be a disease of older people, of seniors, and now it's not. So we have to ask what's going on with our children. So yeah, leukemia is the number one childhood cancer. Cancer is the second leading cause of death in children. One in 218 will get cancer. Children will get cancer in the U.S. These are U.S. numbers because the numbers are far less in other developed countries. They have far fewer vaccines given in other developed countries. In fact, some countries like Japan don't vaccinate until the children are 2 years old because we have, you know, systems that are still very vulnerable until we're a little bit older and we're a little more robust. So, yes, you also asked about asthma. Asthma, the numbers are one in every 12 children have asthma these days. And again, that was not the case in the 80s either. Now they have to have inhalers and EpiPens for asthmatic cases as well in schools. And so one in 12 would be two in every classroom probably has asthma. And it's also it's the leading cause of emergency room visits in children. So it is, and I believe it's the fourth or fifth death. An asthma attack is the fourth or fifth cause of death in children. So these are numbers that are shocking and definitely much higher than in the 80s or the early 90s. So what happened in the late 80s, which can give you an idea of why this happened, there was a law that was passed. So there were so many lawsuits over vaccine injuries and deaths flooding the court system, right? And we have a capitalist society. That's how we protect ourselves from companies that are producing bad products, is through the legal system. And lawsuits were flooding the courts in the late 1980s. So the pharmaceutical companies went to Congress and went to President Reagan and said, we're going to stop making vaccines. You have to give us federal protection from lawsuits. So the pharmaceutical industry in regards to vaccines became one of the only federally protected products in the U.S. that you cannot sue for if you have an injury or a death as a side effect of the vaccines. And the studies show that those are definitely side effects. You can look at the product insert that the manufacturers write, and you will see these listed as potential side effects. So The vaccines are pretty much one of the only protected products in the U.S. And why do they have to be protected if they're so safe? You know, and that liability law, it's called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act in 1986, was passed by Congress and put into law by Reagan. And it gave pharmaceutical companies complete liability protection. So let's look at Vioxx that I sold, right? They paid out $6 billion in liability cases for one drug. Well, with vaccines, they don't have that liability. So the number of vaccines that they put on the market and they got on the childhood schedule skyrocketed. So it's quadrupled. So in 1983, there were only 20 doses of vaccines by age 18. By last year, 2018, there were 72 by age 18. So we're looking at a huge number of increased vaccines. And basically anyone over the age of 40, you're not fully vaccinated, according to the CDC. And so it's kind of this herd immunity, you know, idea again is another myth that's pushed by the pharmaceutical industry, because there is no herd immunity. A, you can't create herd immunity through vaccines. It's only through the natural strain of the virus that you can develop immunity to. And B, the adult population is not is not fully vaccinated. So there is no herd immunity, this whole facade that they're using to push vaccines. But basically, after that law came into play, the vaccine makers no longer had liability. So the schedule skyrocketed. And
yeah, and that was my biggest issue with it, right? Is we had House Bill 3063 in the Oregon legislative session this past summer that eventually died, but it's going to come back in the next session. And the massive increase in mandated vaccines for your child even to go to a school and removing any medical or religious exemptions from this, that's what really bothered me about that. I mean, if it's such a great idea, why does it have to be mandatory, right?
Exactly. And can you even imagine mandating any other pharmaceutical product? I mean, think about it. Can you, you know, mandating opiates for pain, right? Anyone comes in with depression, they mandate an antidepressant. You know, this is where pharmaceutical companies want to go. And it's a very slippery slope with medical mandates. But I mean, how could anyone trust the pharmaceutical industry enough to want a mandated law?
I think that's where I want to play a little bit of devil's advocate with you here, because for most of the 20th century, vaccines were a medical miracle. You look at the eradication of polio, you look at the limitation of measles and mumps. And
I'm going to have to stop you there, because you haven't looked at the data, because the historical data does not say that. And there was an analysis, a report in the Journal of Pediatrics in December 2000 that states vaccination and antibiotics were not responsible for the decrease in infectious disease decline mortality. They looked at mortality rates. Vaccines were not introduced until like 1963. If you look at the stats and the historical data on it, it absolutely does not support that. It absolutely doesn't support that. And that's in the science and that's in the data. If you look up the historical annals of the United States, we had the top five diseases killers in 1900. Tuberculosis was number two. We never had a vaccine for tuberculosis. Do you see droves of people dying of tuberculosis on the street, or cholera, because there was no vaccine for cholera, or typhoid as well in the U.S.? So obviously, we don't have these anymore. They were eradicated without vaccines. So the idea that these diseases decline because of vaccines is a complete pharmaceutical myth. They have used that myth and pushed it to push these laws. So if you look at the data, and I have a great page on the website, it's learntherisk.org/diseases. It has all of the stats on there, including a link and the PDF of the December 2000 report, stating that 90% of infectious disease deaths occurred before vaccines and few antibiotics were available. It's just not the case. It's just part of their myth.
So what did lead to the decrease in mortality then?
So if you look at the in the early 1900s, we had many things going on. It was the Industrial Revolution. So we had masses of people flocking into cities which didn't have clean water, didn't have sanitation, and didn't have food resources. So we also had two world wars going on. So all of those death rates and infectious disease in of soldiers in the battlefield were also included in those numbers. So sanitation, the CDC has a report that says it was chlorinated water. I don't believe that chlorinated water is the savior. But anyway, the CDC says that it was chlorinated water. And sanitation, food resources, and water resources in these newly packed cities, new urban areas. People were living in squalor. You've probably seen a lot of the photos from that time. There was no sewage treatment, no sanitation, no water resources, or very few water resources, and very few food resources. So when these things started to change in the 1930s, 1940s, this is when the disease rates went down and disease death rates, especially after the end of World War II, because there was World War I, there was the Industrial Revolution, World War I, and then World War II not far behind. And all of those stats were included in the U.S. death rates. So that's when. And the measles vaccine didn't even come onto market until 1963. And, you know, a lot of these other hepatitis B, hepatitis liver disease rates have actually increased since the hepatitis B vaccine was released, and it's supposed to fight, you know, the potential for liver disease and liver cancer. So if you actually look into the statistics, all of these kind of ideas that we've been taught to believe without any real basis are actually not true. So, and polio's a very interesting situation in and of itself. And, you know, if you want to go into that, I can give you a brief summary. DDT spraying was very, very widespread after World War II. So after World War II, the U.S. had a whole bunch of chemical warfare left over, and the chemical companies wanted to know what to do with it. So it was repurposed as a pesticide, an insecticide, actually. And this is why you see polio. So polio is a virus, and then there's paralysis. It's two different things. There's the polio virus, and then there's paralysis. So when you say polio, you're meaning paralysis, which we still have many, many, many cases of childhood paralysis. They just don't call it polio. And so the DDT was repurposed as an insecticide, and it was sprayed mostly in farm areas, sometimes over, you can see videos from the 1940s, 1950s, over pools. They sprayed it at beaches. They had ads selling DDT to parents as an insecticide. Put it in your child's bathtub, put it in their lunchbox. And most of the cases of paralysis were in children. And most of the cases happened in the summer, which is farming season. It's not a coincidence. And there were some brilliant scientists that went to Congress in the 50s and said, you know, what's happening here is the DDT is causing paralysis in children. And the U.S. government, on the back of two world wars, couldn't really admit that they made a mistake. So they silently decreased DDT spraying. They banned DDT for causing nervous system paralysis. In the early 70s after Silent Spring, that book came out from Rachel Carson, and they decided to create a story. And they said, okay, well, we have this guy over here. Polio is an endemic virus. So we all carry different viruses in our bodies. We have about 12 at once in our bodies. And polio, there's different endemic viruses in different areas. And polio is one of those that's very endemic to the U.S., particularly the central U.S. So they started saying, okay, well, it's the polio virus that's causing paralysis. And even though less than half of the childhood paralysis cases actually were positive for poliovirus, they stopped testing for poliovirus when someone came in with paralysis because only half of the children with paralysis actually had the poliovirus in them. But that didn't go along with their story. So they stopped using the actual poliovirus testing. And they made Jonas Salk a nationwide hero. They put him on magazines, newspapers, TV, and said it was the vaccine that contributed to the decrease in polio cases. But if you look at the statistics, that doesn't add up. The polio was well on the decline before the vaccine was actually widespread. And areas without the vaccine had decreases in polio as well. And and then there was the whole fiasco with the live polio virus vaccine, which was very dangerous. And anyway, polio is quite an interesting story about how they have manipulated mindset. And they did the same with Zika a few years ago, right? Zika came out of nowhere and they launched it as a huge, oh, we have to be afraid of the Zika virus. Yet they ignored the report of scientists in the area of Brazil saying that chemicals were being sprayed in that area. New chemicals were being tried by chemical companies, Monsanto being one of them, in the area of Brazil where they had the Zika. And there were scientists in South America that came out with this report, and it was completely covered up, blamed on the Zika virus. And then guess who has the patent on the Zika virus vaccine, which is coming out?
I would imagine it's one of the pharmaceutical companies.
Actually, it's the U.S. Army. You can look that up on Google. So now the government is going to be profiting off a vaccine for Zika. And why don't you hear about Zika right now? Because you will hear about it again when the vaccine is ready. Right now, the vaccine's in production. So, but when it starts to come closer to the time when it's licensed, you will hear a lot more about Zika. But that they created this whole Zika fiasco so that they could get investment to put the vaccine into production. So they did exactly what they did with polio. It worked so well that people, that they are doing it with Zika. And if you look into the Zika scare and, you know, Google the patent for the Zika virus and all of that, you can, you know, it's a rabbit hole that will be very interesting for you to go down. But what we know about polio and what we've been told and what the data and the science and the historical annals show is two different things.
So to sum it all up, you've said your children are not vaccinated at all. You believe that the vaccines, if I may, vaccines in general are not worth what they're being marketed as. They're not providing the medical benefit that everybody says that they do.
So when you inject a virus, you bypass the cellular immune system, which begins in the nose, the eyes, the ears, and the mouth. And this is how for thousands of years we've been exposed to viruses, and that's how immunity is created. You cannot create immunity solely through antibodies, and that's what vaccines target. But that is only a small part of the immune system. I have a great page on that as well on the website. And so vaccines don't work like they say, but they do have chemicals in them that do create side effects and health issues. And we are now seeing that in our childhood population, as well as adults. 1 in 5 women over 40 have an autoimmune disease now. And the science is there. Thousands of studies showing the link between autoimmune issues and vaccines. Again, I have thousand studies on the website, learntherisk.org. And, you know, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant marketing scheme by pharma. And above all, the pharmaceutical industry is a marketing industry rather than a pharmaceutical industry, because they can create and pump out products that you beg them for and that are actually harming you and require you to buy more products from them. And this is how they have become the most profitable and the most powerful industry in the world. And until people wake up, we are never going to see a change. We're only going to get sicker and sicker and sicker. And, you know, we have to take back our health. And in our children, this generation of children, this is the first one that experts say will not outlive their parents. And to me, that is shocking. That signals that we are definitely doing something wrong as a species. You know, we didn't survive for tens of thousands of years without vaccines to then only, you know, have to have one on the day of birth, have many before even being born. And then, you know, we were never vaccine deficient. We were never pharmaceutical drug deficient, never vaccine deficient. And somehow we've been brainwashed to believe that we were. So.
All right. You know, Brandy, thank you so much for being on the Behind the Curtain podcast. Give a quick shout out again for the Oregonians for Medical Freedom event this Thursday. Give us the details on that.
Yes, it's Thursday, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Shiloh Inn, and I hope we pack the house because to me, this is, you know, our health. If we don't have our health, we have nothing. This is one of the most important discussions that we have on our plate today, because, you know, 70% of bankruptcies in the U.S. are a result of medical issues. This is, you know, they're basically enslaving us as a society and keeping us sick. And we really have to step out of that and take back our health for our children, for ourselves, for our families. And we need to get this information widespread. And parents really need to do the research. They should do research on vaccines just as much, and drugs just as much as they do the stroller, you know, and the car seat they're going to get. And, you know, I'm just not seeing it. So I hope that this conversation and the talk on Thursday, I hope that it really opens people's eyes and inspires people to really do the research that everybody should do, so that we can make real educated decisions for our family, for ourselves, and for our society in general.
All right. Brandi Vaughn, thank you so much again. Go to learntherisk.org to learn more about everything that Brandi has researched, and do your own research. And Brandi, I look forward to seeing you and meeting you in person on Thursday. Thanks for checking out the Behind the Curtain podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next week for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Great-grandpa sailed here from across the ocean. Nothing else but his dream for a better life. His folks over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion. But deep down in his heart, he knew he was right. He cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sing, I am America. This land is my land, America. I know one day after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along, and that's what makes this country so strong. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay. Like so many others, he fought for the cause with great devotion. And just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud. America.